Okay, United States of America versus approximately $281,111. Mr. Hecht.
Your Honors, may it please the court, I am David Hecht, representing the appellant Min Yang, one of the appellants. It is undisputed that the appellant is an innocent victim here, a victim that did nothing but wish to legally emigrate to the United States. He attempted to emigrate here after finding a high-end immigration consulting firm in China that was made up of both Americans and Chinese, but that company turned out to be a fraud. Appellant was scammed, defrauded by this cadre of criminals connected to the sham immigration consulting company, some of whom pled guilty, one of whom was convicted, the others have been indicted, but remain fugitives. The government doesn't dispute any of these facts. It was confirmed by the criminals and employees from Department of Homeland Security that there was no evidence that any claimant was involved in any criminal misconduct. This case is about a bank account, or at least in this appellant's instance, containing nearly $300,000 that Mr. Yang was instructed as part of what he believed was a totally legal process to deposit into an account. If the criminals had not been caught, they would have taken the money as payment, as admitted by one of the criminals, Mr. Wayne. The bank account and the monies therein were never touched by the criminals in furtherance of their scams. The money is Mr. Yang's, and unfortunately, the government was able to take those funds as part of an overreaching forfeiture action. Several errors in the underlying district court action and trial are why we are here today. And the harm is significant because Appellant Yang has really suffered twice. First, his dream of emigrating to the United States was destroyed, nothing but a mirage. And then after that, his money has been improperly seized because of an overly intrusive government, despite no intention that
The government proved a violation of the money laundering statute, didn't it?
Well, not
the conspirators laundered the money with the intent, the conspirators laundered the money with the intent to promote the carrying on of visa fraud.
So I think when you look at this particular money, then the laundering was kind of, it was not completed, right? Because this money remained in the appellant's control. So this was really one part of a scheme that was not completed. So I would argue that no, and under the money laundering statute, we're getting to this argument, one of the three grounds for the appeal is that the statute itself says, and we're talking about 19 U.S.C. 1956 A2A, there is an intent prong that whoever transports, transmits, or transfers, or attempts to transport, transmit.
Well, the laundering, it was done with the intent.
The laundering...
To promote a specified unlawful activity, which is visa fraud.
It depends on who you're talking about. For the criminals, they may have had that intent, but the intention of this money by this from this appellant had nothing to do with any kind of a crime. It was everything.
Once you've proved that, all the government then has to show is a substantial connection between the property and the offense.
They also have to show the intent. That was the improper jury instruction.
I don't know where that comes from. You say that, but I don't see where that comes from in the law.
It's right in the statute, and it's also echoed, it's in statute 1956A2A.
That's the money laundering violation, which is the conspirator's intent.
We don't know that that's the conspirator's intent because it doesn't say that.
That's how the money laundering statute's violated here, as I understand the theory of this case.
That might be the government's theory of the case, but when you read the statute—
They're the ones who charged the crime.
Sure, but here, in the instance of this bank account, there was no intent by the party who controls the account to commit any kind of crime. And I think that's
For forfeiture, all the government has to prove is that the property is subject to forfeiture. That is, the property was used to commit or facilitate the commission of a criminal offense or was involved in the commission of a criminal offense. They just have to show a substantial connection between the property and the offense. There's not an intent requirement there.
But the forfeiture statute directly references 1956 as well as 57 and 60. And this court in another action, they call it the Regions case, which is 449 Federal Appendix 871, despite no clear language, to your honor's point,
The problem, Mr. Heck, is I don't see where this or where the text requires the government to improve to prove both the intent of the criminal who committed money laundering and the intent of the property owner. Those are two different things.
My argument is that the one statute references the other, and in order to satisfy the money laundering
statute. But the statute it references is dealing with a criminal offense committed by someone else, not necessarily the property.
Well, I think we need to take a macro view, because here, when you look at the 30,000 foot view, then this would basically swallow any victim who had, in any innocent victim who has done nothing but had money that was taken by a criminal. That's the issue, right? And that's why I think we have to read the statute this way. And I understand—
Mr. Heck, may I ask you a question? I guess, is this your main argument, or are you relying on the inability to enter the country?
That is another one of our arguments.
So I want to ask you about that. Your client did not apply for an entry visa.
That is correct. It would have actually been kind of useless to do so in light of the State Department's known policy not to allow anyone connected to the particular criminals into the United States. And so it would have been a futile attempt to do so.
Is there any evidence that you put on that you presented that would show it would have been futile?
Aside from the blanket policy of the State Department, which we point to in our briefs, yes.
No. I'm not talking about a legal argument. I'm saying, did you present evidence? Did you make a record to show that it would have been futile?
There is no record that this particular appellant, factually did anything or brought up that fact. Aside from in conversations with the court, I think it was a pre-motion conference, there were issues relating to whether or not this appellant could be could enter the United States, and prior counsel had chimed in and said that was a particular issue, and that he was trying to push for mediation in light of the burden that the appellant would have in the trial court.
But he was represented by counsel.
He was represented by counsel indeed, except there was an instruction. Because of the lack of his ability to attend, not only was there an adverse inference, there was an instruction that would have caused the jury to conclude that there was a reason that these people were not, this being the appellant and others, were not allowed into the United States.
Hey, Mr. Heck, you've saved 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Shields.
Hey, please, the court, just to kind of follow up on some of the points that were made by Mr. Heck, I represent four of the claimants, and referencing back the pretrial conference, and it's noted in all the briefs, the government acknowledged that none of the movements were going to be allowed to enter the country. Now, and that's in January of 2019, a good 8 months before the trial. And clearly blocked these claimants from entering the country. Then in August of 2019, they report to the court that the government has come up with a plan that perhaps will allow them to be entered on a temporary visa, which was then followed up with, the State Department won't allow that. Then they came and said Homeland Security will be allowed to parole them in, but they acknowledge that they don't really have sufficient time to do it. Prior counsel provided the information to Homeland Security within a matter of days. They came back and acknowledged to the court that they simply couldn't process it and allow these people to enter the country. And you can see one of the things that the government claims is that the money was used for this nefarious purpose, but you have to acknowledge the fact that when the trial was conducted, every person who that came to trial and testified, the jury found that they were innocent owners and that they then were allowed, their money was returned to them. All of those who did not attend had theirs forfeited.
Yeah, but you know, that doesn't mean you were denied due process.
Well, I think
they had notice, they had an opportunity to be heard, they were represented by counsel, they could have put on evidence, they could have testified via live video feed, they could have, it appears they could have submitted even affidavits, the district court would have admitted that. I mean, you had an opportunity to put on more than you did.
Right, but if you look at the Helminski case, I think in particular, that kind of addresses the right to be present at trial and to participate and to present your case. You know, in Helminski,
there's not a right to be present at trial for the civil proceeding for a foreign national who the nation has a sovereign right to exclude.
Well, I think for the purposes of due process, you do. I acknowledge that, you know, the government has the right to say certain people cannot enter the country. I don't think there's any disagreement about that.
Right.
However, having said that, we now have the CAFRI provision that allows innocent owner defense. So in terms of due process,
you have a lawyer, you can put on evidence.
Yeah, but the lawyer can't talk. The lawyer can't testify. And that's kind of one of the comments that was made.
Couldn't the client have testified versus video conferencing?
I don't know if they had the capability or the ability to do that. I can tell you.
Why wouldn't they have had that?
I don't know that I know the answer to that. I know that there were attempts to do deposition.
Well, I mean, if the objection here is a due process objection, weren't you obliged to make a record about it?
The prior counsel addressed that in the January meeting, that they weren't going to be available, but the issue of other means to get the testimony, I don't know that there's a record that reflects how that was discussed or not.
Okay.
Now, back to the issue about, I think it is clear that the Constitution applies to them. With regard to due process, that one of the things that the government maintains is that they're non-resident, and because their money was used in this scheme, that deprives them of the substantial connection. And I point the court to, you know, there's a whole series of cases about the fact that non-resident aliens have funds in U.S. banks gives them the substantial connection.
Mr. Shields, you've only saved a minute for rebuttal. If you keep talking, you're going to knock
out. I'll stop, Judge. Thank you.
Mr. Bodner.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, appellant's counsel. Your Honors, I want to correct a few things factually in the record first, because what was explained particularly by Mr. Hecht is not what is actually in the record. And with regard to the $300,000 that was put in the United States, this was not money, as was explained at trial, that was intended to go to the criminal defendants. All of the claimants paid their money, $300,000, to the defendants to be part of this program, to have these documents made up for them, which, as we showed in the criminal trial and as we showed in the civil trial, were fraudulent.
Yeah, but they, you know, so, and what argument are you trying to address?
Just noting that the $300,000 that was placed into the U.S. bank account was a facade. This was money that was made to make the joint venture appear more real. And that was the basis of the
substantial. Is this in response to Mr. Hecht's argument? I'm just trying to make sure.
Yes, Your Honor. It's in response to Mr. Hecht had talked about the $300,000.
Mr. Hecht said that you were required to prove the property owner's intent. As I understand the law, that's not true, is it?
Correct. That is not true, Your Honor. We agree with that.
This is civil forfeiture, right? It's an in rem proceeding, right?
Absolutely.
It's a proceeding against property.
Correct.
Right. And it's an ancient remedy that has never required proof of the property owner's criminal intent, has it?
No, we needed to prove that a crime occurred and substantially connected, and we did that. Your Honor, turning to the exclusion of individuals from the United States, again, we can't mix up the parties here. There are five appellants. Min Yang, Hong Tu Chen, and Wei Hong did not apply and were not excluded from the United States by the State Department. Zidai and Lin Lin Gao were denied entry visas in January. It was brought to the United States' attention in August, 7 weeks before trial, which is detailed in the record. And as the United States noted before the district court, and this is in document 246, both Zidai and Lin Lin Gao had been denied entry into the US prior to this, unrelated to anything involving the criminal case. There was no blanket policy by the State Department to keep people out. And for all the reasons that the court already explained, they did receive due process. They had the ability to avail themselves of the federal court system. They filed a lawsuit. They had attorneys. And their attorneys argued largely that the United States had not met its burden as to the substantial connection. So there was argument put on. There was vociferous cross-examination. They received due process here, Your Honor. There is nothing wrong with what occurred here constitutionally. The district court's instruction was correct as a matter of law. And the one other issue that wasn't touched on, but the denial of the directed verdict was also correct. And Your Honor, if there's no further questions on this, the United States rests on its brief and cedes the remainder of its time.
Judge Schlesinger, you have any questions? No. Judge McGowan, no. Okay. Mr. Heck, you've got 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I guess the government admitted there is a blanket policy that was in the record, and I just want to be clear on that. And I did want to also address the sort of empty chair syndrome, as well as the video conferencing. The appellant actually wanted to watch this proceeding today, but being located in China was unable to. I know that's not in the record, but you know, we all know that China and other states outside of the United States routinely block traffic to the United States, and also some countries have policies that you actually cannot stand for deposition or other kind of testimony. So I wanted to put that into the record, or I wanted to put that into your consideration. And I think that as far as what the $300,000 was going to be used for, that was something that it is undisputed that the appellant had no knowledge of, and you know whether or not he had $300,000 and could deposit in a U.S. bank account was not criminal. He did not do anything to advance. So I think the fundamental problem with this case is that this is fundamentally unfair to have an innocent appellant or an innocent victim of a crime who then gets money seized simply because there is, you know, this court is interpreting.
So the innocent owner defense is something that the property owner bears the burden of proving. There's no requirement of proof of the intent on the part of the government in making its case.
Well, I think that as far as the directed verdict, that would have been the proper remedy also here because of the complete lack of any evidence that anything was amiss, and that would have there was an innocent owner defense put up and was really shown by
there was testimony about what was being done here, that the $300,000 there was testimony about that.
There was, and that all supports the JMAL. That should be overturned.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hack. Mr. Shields, you saved a minute.
Just in following up, one of the things that the government said is that they were obviously able to participate and provide a defense and stuff. And what Mr. Heck said is probably as clear as possible. The empty chair situation. You know, when a jury's hearing the case, if they're not able to hear from the witness or the party, they are severely handicapped. And it was clear from the result of the trial that those who were able to testify prevailed and those who were excluded lost. And I don't know that it can be any more clearer than that.
Did everyone who prevailed
attend? All but one.
So one of them prevailed who didn't attend. Is that right?
I'm sorry, one who attended did not prevail.
I see. All right. Any other questions?
If there are no other questions, I'll rest.
Thank you, Mr. Shields. We are adjourned for the week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.